Come now to oral questions. First, in the name of the Right Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does he stand by all of his government's statements and actions?
Yes, I do, and especially our announcement of new targets for at least 80% of students regularly attending school and 80% of Year 8 students at or above the expected curriculum level for their age in reading, writing and maths. These are critical things to make sure that our kids can get the quality education they have and can follow the dreams that they have. Finally, we have a government that's getting New Zealand back on track, getting our kids back to school, making sure they're going to do well.
Supplementary, why did he say yesterday that the Suicide Prevention Office would remain open when the Ministry of Health officials were saying at the same time that it wouldn't?
As I said yesterday, the Ministry of Health said that they did not adequately brief the Minister. The Minister has made it very clear the functions of the Suicide Prevention Office will remain open.
Supplementary question, were any ministers in his government briefed on the Ministry of Health's proposal to wind up the Suicide Prevention Office before it became public knowledge?
Again, I don't know how to be any clearer. We've had the Ministry of Health come out and say they did not adequately brief the Minister. Within a very quick and short period of time, the Minister responded by saying he wanted the functions of the Suicide Prevention Office to remain, and they will remain.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. I think the Prime Minister might have missed my question. I was asking about any ministers in his government. Of course, there are multiple ministers in health. The minister that he's referring to is not the vote minister, that is the Minister of Health. I was asking him whether any ministers in his government had been briefed on the proposal before it became public.
Well, I think he probably did answer that, but he could perhaps say something else.
Well, I feel like I have answered it. I've answered it yesterday, I'm answering it again today. As I said, the Ministry of Health said they did not adequately brief the Minister. The Minister for Mental Health has come out and said that he wants the functions of the Suicide Prevention Office to remain, and they will remain. That's the situation.
Was the Minister of Health or any other minister in his government briefed on the Ministry's proposals before they were made public?
No.
Supplementary question. Why did Ministry of Health officials just yesterday say that the role of the Director of the Suicide Prevention Office will not be filled, other roles in the Suicide Prevention Office will be cut, and the work of the office would be integrated into other ministry work, which to most people sounds like the office is being wound up?
Well, I can reassure you, the Minister has been very clear to say that the functions of the Suicide Prevention Office will remain.
Supplementary question. Will he guarantee that his government's proposal to cut jobs from the Ministry of Health, including from the tobacco regulation team, will not lead to an increase in youth smoking?
We are determined as a government to deliver on the smoke-free 2025 targets. As that member well knows, we've had good progress in the last 12 months and we're going to march towards a 5% daily smoker target under smoke-free 2025.
So that's a no. Supplementary question. Will he guarantee that his government's proposal to cut 6.5% from the budgets of customs will not lead to longer lines at airports, delays for our importers and exporters, and more illicit drugs entering New Zealand?
Well, what I can say to that member is that we finally have a government that can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can end the wasteful spending, we can prioritise frontline services, we can deliver tax relief for low and middle income workers, folk that that member's party used to care about, and we can make sure we can grow this economy.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
A point of order, right on with Chris Hipkins.
That can't possibly come anywhere close to addressing the question that I had asked the Prime Minister. I asked him whether he would guarantee that there wouldn't be more illicit drugs coming into the country, longer lines at airports or delays for...
And that is the problem. You're asking him to give a guarantee, which is in the nature of a yes-no answer. And I ruled those out yesterday.
Yeah, but he at least needs to address the question. He doesn't. I admit I can't make him say yes or no, but he at least needs to talk about the question that was asked, well, as opposed to whatever he feels like.
Not going to debate it with you, but I don't think asking someone to guarantee something and then saying they must address that is any way different from asking for a yes or no answer. Please ask another sub.
Mr. Speaker, will he guarantee that his proposal to cut 6.5% from the customs budget won't lead to longer times at airports, won't lead to delays for our importers and exporters, and won't lead to more illicit drugs entering New Zealand?
What I can reassure that member is that this will be a government that will rebuild our economy, restore law and order, and deliver better public services in health and education.
Question number two, Stuart Smith.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What announcements has she made about tax?
the Honourable Nicola Willis.
Mr Speaker, the answer to this question is that 2 weeks ago I released the government's budget policy statement. This confirmed that there will be personal income tax relief in the budget. And it noted that New Zealanders have not seen any changes to personal income rates and thresholds since 2010, apart from Labor's introduction of a higher top tax rate. Now, for 14 years, people have been taxed more and more as their incomes have risen, much of that due to inflation. This government will start to address that in Budget 2024.
Supplementary. What have been the consequences of not adjusting tax brackets?
Well, Mr Speaker, I can give the House an example, because I'm acutely aware that there are members of this House who adamantly oppose tax reduction for working people. In 2011, the median full-time wage and salary worker earned $48,000 and paid 15.5% of their income in tax. Today, the median full-time wage and salary worker earns $73,400. He may not like it, but he should listen to the fact, because today, that wage earner pays 20.6% of their income in tax, as compared to 15.5% in 2011. In other words, Mr Speaker, and actually the Leader of the Opposition should listen rather than interrupt, the average tax rate for someone who, by definition, is right in the middle of the income distribution has gone up by more than 5 percentage points. And that has happened because of the neglect and indifference of what long ago was known as the party of the worker.
Point of order, the Right Honourable Chris Hipkins.
The government continues on a daily basis to directly challenge your ruling as the Speaker, and that was another blatant example of it. Not only did you not stop Nicola Willis for a blatant attack on the previous government, but you actually allowed her to deliver a speech rather than an answer to the question.
Well, with all due respect, there was quite a lot of interjection going on during that time. And I think that while the speech was too long, the answer was too long.
I rest my case.
Yeah, well, I've never been one for long speeches, but it was too long an answer. But I don't think that you could say that was an attack on the previous government. Talking about what has historically happened is not unreasonable and not outside standing orders. Beg your pardon? Well, maybe I didn't hear it because of some of the noise that was going on. But I will have a look at that on Hansa. I'm trying to do my best to be fair and even. Stuart Smith.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Why is the government concerned about fiscal drag?
Well, Mr Speaker, I note there's a lot of sensitivity about the answers to these questions. The fiscal drag I have described...
With all due respect, that doesn't help things either. So just start the answer again.
Sure. Well, the fiscal drag I have described affects people at all levels of income. As the years go by, they find themselves paying an increasing share of their earnings and income tax. And this can affect people's perceptions of fairness in the tax system and, as a result, have a negative impact on compliance. Also, as people move into higher tax brackets, they face higher marginal tax rates, which can be a disincentive to work. This government wants people to see a future for themselves and their families in New Zealand where they can get ahead if they work hard and keep more of their own money.
Stuart Smith.
Will personal income tax relief in Budget 2024 be inflationary?
Mr Speaker, no. Tax relief will be funded by reducing government consumption and increasing revenue elsewhere, all sitting within the Budget 2024 operating allowance.
Good.
Furthermore, that allowance will be lower than the allowance set by the previous government. This means that tax relief is affordable, we will not be borrowing extra to pay for it, and tax relief will not add to inflationary pressures.
Question number three, Chloe Swarbrick.
To the Prime Minister, does he stand by all of his government's statements and actions?
Yes, and especially our announcement of 9 priority targets, including reducing New Zealand's net greenhouse gas emissions to align with our 2050 net zero climate goal. Of course, we're going to achieve that by fast-track consenting so we can get more renewable energy like wind farms built We're going to remove the GE ban to empower our world-class agri-scientists to actually manage methane emissions down. And, of course, we're going to restore integrity to the ETS scheme.
Does the Prime Minister stand by his answer to me at question time yesterday that the Climate Change Commission's draft advice on biogenic methane is, quote, speculation, end quote?
Untestable.
I don't think I expressed it in those terms.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. I can quote directly from the Hansard.
What will I call you?
Point of order, Mr. Speaker.
A point of order, close format.
I would quote directly from the Hansard in which the Prime Minister responded to a direct quote from the Climate Change Commission's
report.
That
is not a point of order.
All right, Mr. Speaker, may I have another supplementary then to probe this point?
Certainly not an extra one.
Carry on. Mr. Speaker. What does he understand the role of the Climate Change Commission to be?
Well, it provides important advice to the government about the state of climate change in New Zealand.
Recommendations only.
Does he then... supplementary, Mr. Speaker. Does he then agree with the Climate Change Commission who said on Monday, and I quote, there has not been an important or notable change in the understanding of the physical science on methane and how it warms the atmosphere? Or is he to extend his logic also to reopen the science on, say, gravity?
I don't know how to answer the last part of that question, but what I'd just say is that we are determined to make sure that we update the science base on methane. It has changed over the last 5 years. It's changed over the last 10 years. It'll change in the next 5 years, in the next 10 years. It's important that we get a common base of understanding of science knowledge so we can set the right targets.
Just wait.
What exactly is wrong with the Climate Change Commission's science such that the government feels compelled to open a secondary review on the science of methane?
Sorry, I missed the question.
Sorry,
I missed the question.
Could the member ask the question again?
What does the Prime Minister consider is wrong with the Climate Change Commission's science on methane?
Nothing particularly. We have two reviews going on answering slightly different questions to make sure that we get a common understanding of the science base.
Question number four, and then over to the Honourable Barbara Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What process, if any, has she established for portfolio ministers and cabinet to review and approve the cost-saving proposals currently being consulted on by agencies through the initial baseline exercise?
Mr. Speaker, ministers were asked in late December to work with their agencies to develop credible savings options for Budget 2024. Chief executives were expected to exercise good judgment in putting forward savings proposals, and ministers have worked with agencies to refine them. The savings exercise is an ongoing and iterative process, including through budget bilaterals between myself and various ministers. Cabinet will be asked to approve the full budget package.
Is it your expectation that ministers will understand the full implications of the agency's final cost savings plans prior to Cabinet considering the budget package as set out in question time yesterday?
Yes.
Supplementary. Is she concerned then that agency cuts won't be finalised prior to Cabinet considering Budget 2024? And how does she expect her colleagues to consider and reject those proposals if the budget has already been finalised?
Well, Mr. Speaker, there's two things happening here. The first is that agencies, as a matter of course, routinely and have for many years make decisions to restructure their entities in order to focus on their core priorities and to drive efficiency. Some of the changes that are underway and change processes that are happening across the public service now are actually the result of reforms by the previous government. For example, in the case of Health New Zealand, it was always an expectation that there would then be reductions in the number of roles at the Ministry of Health. The second thing that is happening here is that in some cases agencies have made decisions at an operational level to begin change processes and to consult on those change processes.
How can the Minister of Health meet her expectations to understand the impact of the Ministry of Health's cuts prior to Cabinet agreeing the budget when final decisions are not expected to come until June?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think I just answered that in my previous answer.
Supplementary. How can she say that her colleagues are able to reject proposals to freeze hiring at Oranga Tamariki and police, or cut jobs from the tobacco regulation team at Health or the Suicide Prevention Office when these are being finalised after Cabinet agrees her budget?
Because, Mr Speaker, many entities have put forward proposals that ministers have rejected. That is happening, that has happened, and I suspect it will continue to happen.
Supplementary. Is it not the case that she will pursue significant cost-cutting to pay for her tax cuts package without knowing the full impact on the public while leaving her colleagues to front the consequences of her decisions?
Mr Speaker, I want to tell you about the impact it had on the public when that government chose to increase spending at a rapid rate. And the decisions that we are taking, we campaigned on. Because we saw the growth of more than 18,000...
Take your seat. After all the discussion that we've had in recent days, don't start a question like that, an answer like that. Attacks on the opposition for their political activities are not reasonable. Referencing decisions that they've made and the consequence of those decisions as they affect portfolios now is in order, but the way that was presented was not quite to form.
Point of order, Mr Speaker.
Honourable Chris Bishop.
The only one that needs rescuing is your deputy leadership, but anyway. Mr Speaker.
Just hang on. We've got normal. Just a minute. We've got a point of order being taken. They're heard in silence.
There's been a protocol, Mr Speaker, that political questions get political answers. That was quite a political question. Very serious, quite charged, politically charged allegation inherent in the question. And the Minister of Finance is responding in a political way. That's always been the rule, sir, that political questions get political answers. Straight questions deserve straight answers. Is now the rule that political questions can't be political in their answers?
No, of course not. But your version, your assessment of what is a politically charged question and mine are clearly different. Your view on what is a reasonable answer and mine are different, but mine will prevail. Does the Minister wish to... Point of order, the Honourable Kieran McAnulty.
Thank you very much, Mr Speaker. We absolutely accept that point of orders will be heard in silence, but we also... believe that the rule that points of orders should solely be points of orders should also be followed, and when they're not, it's likely to lead to disorder in the House.
That is true. Given the nature of the ruling, I decided to let that slide, but it won't be happening again. So, Minister, would you like to answer the question, or would you like to hear it again?
Oh, no, I'm fine. Look, Mr Speaker, I can offer the member opposite real reassurance that every single member of this government supports our decision to offer tax relief to working people by reprioritising some of the wasteful spending that was put in place by those members.
Question number 5, Mark Cameron.
Thank you,
just
Mr.
Wait a minute. Just
Speaker.
Give the House a moment to settle.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Agriculture, Animal Welfare Skills. What recent announcements, if any, has he made in his portfolio?
Honourable Andrew Hoggard.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Today, the Minister of Agriculture and I announced our intention to improve freshwater farm plans to make them more cost-effective and pragmatic for farmers. I see freshwater farm plans as a key tool to support farmers to enhance the freshwater environment in the future, but the current system is too costly, too complex, and too inflexible. This announcement signals the government's intention to make farm plans fit for purpose and aligned to the particular circumstances of each farm and catchment.
Supplementary.
Mark Cameron.
Point of order, Mr Speaker. I'm just seeking your guidance. Given that this is a Patsy question, it was filed to the Associate Minister of Agriculture, Animal Welfare Skills.
Yeah,
the
no,
press release,
sorry,
which is being alluded
that's
to...
Not a, it's not a point of order.
Mr Speaker, the press release that is being alluded to is from...
It is entirely the Government's decision which Minister will answer a question.
Supplementary. What changes to freshwater farm plans is he considering?
Thank you, Mr Speaker.
Yep.
Yep. The sector has told us that the current system is rigid, with time and money needed to complete a farm plan not lining up with the level of risk for many farmers. Among other things, we will take a look at the certification and auditing requirements of the system, with a view to ensuring that future settings are justifiable on the basis of cost and environmental benefit. We will also make sure that we are doing as much as we can to reduce duplication in farm planning. Many farmers are already doing comprehensive farm plans that in many cases could easily be recognised as equivalent.
Supplementary. What value will an improved farm plan system provide farmers?
In addition to supporting them to protect and enhance the environment, we intend to develop a flexible but robust system where farm plans can be specifically targeted to the unique needs of each farm and catchment. Ideally, these plans could stand in the place of local rules and consents for a range of common farming activities.
Supplementary. What does he intend to do for farmers in areas where freshwater farm plan system is already being implemented?
The system rollout began under the previous government in parts of some regions, including the Waikato and Southland, where farmers have to put these plans or have them developed by early next year. We want to give as much certainty as possible to farmers as we work through these changes, especially those that may already be putting their plans together. As part of that, we may look into whether the current requirements to complete freshwater farm plans could be paused.
Question number six, in the name of Takutai Tash Kemp.
Tēnā koe te pika. To the Minister for Māori Development, does he stand by all the government's policies and actions?
Kei te tino tautoko au I te anga whakamua tō tātou kāwanatanga me ngā mihi mata koakoa ki tō tātou Premier I ōna kōrero Tonga Rerewa I te mane e hangā mai nei he whāinga mō tātou katoa.
Māra Mīmau, Kapakingi.
Mōrena. What is his level of involvement regarding the government's policy to remove Section 7AA from the Oranga Tamariki Act, which iwi leaders have stated really clearly will sever iwi partnerships, will further alienate Tamariki Māori from their hakapapa, and lead to more harm of Tamariki Māori in the Crown's care?
E te mango o te whare. He mema au no te kāpenata a ka wānanga e rā momo kaupapa ki te kāpenata.
Supplementary. Was he consulted on the disestablishment of the Māori Health Authority? And if so, was it his? What is his view on the impacts this will have on Māori health inequities?
Te mango o te whare. Ka nui hoki ngā kōrero I kawe atu e mātou o te pāti Nahinara me ngā rōpū haumi ki te kāwanatanga haumi I tēnei take mo te aka whaiora I te wā o te pōti me te mea nei ko tukuna mai e taku manu hauora nei ngā pepa ki te kāpenata, kei roto au te kāpenata, kua kite au I rā pepa.
Supplementary. Was he consulted on the decision to repeal Aotearoa smoke-free legislation, given that the smoke-free Aotearoa campaign was initiated and led by Māori, and smoking is the leading cause of preventable death of our people?
E te mango o te whare. E nei pepa I kawea mai nei e te minita Casey Costello, tērā uri o te nōta, I kawea atu ki te kāpenata, me te mea nei I kite hoki e era pepa.
Supplementary. What advice did he seek regarding the disproportionate impact that scrapping funding for Section 27 reports and sentencing will have on Māori, which experts have stated will lead to further discrimination of Māori in the criminal justice system, higher rates of offending, and higher rates of Māori in prison?
Te mango o te whare. I ki te hoki au I ngā pepa, I tukuna atu ki te kāpenata, me te mō I o hoki ahakoa, kua takahi I tērā ara, ki te whakakore I ngā pūtea tautoko moenga e rā roa, ripoata, e tāia tonu tia ana e te marea e tai ana ki ngā kōti, ki te kawe mai o rātou nawe e pāna ki te āhuatanga, te tuakiritanga o te tangata, tōna hitori, hūtori rānei. Koeira hoki te ara i ngā rua tukau tau, tukau mārima tau, i muri.
Supplementary. What level of involvement did he have in the decision to reintroduce referendums on Māori wards, which breaches Māori rights to representation in local government?
Mr. Speaker, it's absolutely marvellous to see so many Māori councillors on councils throughout the country. The coalition agreements have stated that the Māori wards issues will be put to all constituencies that have not already agreed to the Māori wards. That's what the coalition agreement stated, and that's what we are following today.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker, just if I can just clarify, my question was specifically what level of involvement did he have in the decision to reintroduce referendums on Māori? If I may, thank you.
Mr. Speaker, thank you for that question. I'm a member of Cabinet and we have received papers in relation to that matter, and Cabinet has taken decisions accordingly.
Supplementary. What is his view on the implications that policies such as Fast Track Approvals Bill, the Treaty Principles Bill, the removal of Section 7A from Oranga Tamariki, the ministerial alienation...
Wait, please.
Sorry.
The deal is... I don't want to name anybody here, but we don't speak while a question is being asked. So please start that again.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. What is his view on the implications that policies such as Fast Track Approvals Bill, the Treaty Principles Bill, the removal of Section 7AA from Oranga Tamariki, the ministerial alienation of Te Reo Māori, and the disestablishment of the Māori Health Authority will have on Māori fundamental rights and interests and on the well-being of your and my mokopuna?
Mr. Speaker, I'm a member of the Cabinet, and as a result, I take it very close to heart, the notion of cabinet collective Cabinet responsibility. And there have been a number of issues that have emerged out of various bills and pieces of legislation and policies that you've referred to. And I'm absolutely strengthened and motivated to ensure that the rights and interests of Māori, such as treaty settlements, are preserved through those processes, as you can see in the draft legislation for the Fast Tracks Approvals Bill, which I hope ultimately will be passed, and iwi and other Māori groups can take advantage of that legislation.
Question number seven, Dana Kirkpatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health. What recent announcements has the government made about shorter waiting times for elective treatment?
Honourable Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, earlier this week, the Prime Minister launched ambitious health targets as part of the government's target suite. This will help improve the lives of all New Zealanders. One of these targets was shorter wait times for elective treatment. This target aims to see 95% of people wait less than 4 months for their elective treatments. This won't be easy, but the government is committed to improving the lives of all New Zealanders through better, more efficient public services. We look to deliver the public services that New Zealanders deserve.
Supplementary. Why is an elective target important?
Mr. Speaker, this target was chosen because the treatment times that we used to expect and achieve just 6 years ago have reduced. Wait times for elective treatments have turned into a highly stressful experience, with patients having no certainty as to when they will receive access to the care that they need. As of September 2023, only 62% of patients wait less than 4 months for their elective treatments, down significantly from around 97% in late 2017. This is not good enough, and we want to deliver better care.
Supplementary, is this target too ambitious given the current state of the health system?
Mr. Speaker, this target is not meant to be easy to achieve. We're not here to do what is easy, we're here to do what is needed. Despite the very hard work of our frontline health workforce over the past 6 years, our wait times have continued to grow. That's why we are taking a different approach by putting targets back at the forefront of our decision making. These targets will direct attention and resources and sets a clear agenda for where our health system should be heading.
Supplementary, Dr. Asheville.
Does his ambition include a reduction in the ESP5, or planned care treatment, waitlist in the coming financial year?
Mr Speaker, our ambitions are to improve all of the wait times that we announced in our targets, and as we've said, the baseline will be set as of 1 July 2024.
Dana Kilpatrick.
How will the government track progress against this target?
Mr Speaker, we last achieved 95% between early 2015 and the end of 2017, so we know it is possible. The health agencies will report results each quarter, with the first quarterly results expected to be for the July to September 2024 period. This reporting will be robust to ensure we can target resources appropriately.
Question number 8, Ingrid Neary.
Point of order.
Point of order, the Honourable Matt Ducey.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. I just want to point out, I am preempting this question a bit, that it will be around the Suicide Prevention Office. I'm happy to proceed with the question. I just want to point out my delegation for suicide prevention is not Associate Minister of Health.
I don't know that that's actually a point of order. It's for mental health.
It's in the sheet.
It's not necessarily a point of order, but you managed to make a point, I suppose. Ingrid Neary.
Point of order. Noting that it is, I believe, actually fair to say, because the question was put to the Minister of Mental Health. Minister of Mental Health is confused as to why it's down as the Associate Minister of Health, and given we didn't put it there, I think it doesn't have to be right away, but it would be good to know how it's ended up here like that.
That's fair enough. There is a process that you're well aware of as to how those questions do get put down. That's right, and so I'll take a good look at it. Thanks very much.
Yeah. It does raise a reasonably substantive issue. The government is ultimately responsible for determining which minister is responsible for answering a question. But where the question is a broad one, like whether the minister stands by all of their statements and actions, there can be very limited grounds for transferring that from one minister to another. Because ultimately, the government, if they have transferred it, have determined that the Associate Minister of Health is better to answer questions on whether the Minister of Mental Health stands by their statements and actions or not. That seems a slightly odd decision, given that the Minister of Mental Health is the same person and is in the House. So if the question's been transferred, it must have been the government that transferred it, and they must have a rationale for doing that.
The point of order?
Yep.
This is mysterious. I've just checked, Mr Speaker. The question was lodged to the Minister of Mental Health. The government did not transfer it to the Associate Minister of Health. Somewhere along the line, and I think the clerk is checking right now, the question has made its way from being lodged to the Minister of Mental Health, which I think the Minister of Mental Health was happy to answer in that capacity, and it's gone onto the order paper as the Associate Minister of Health. But the government didn't transfer
it. We could have a massive inquest here, or someone could seek leave for the question to be directed to the Minister for Mental Health.
Mr Speaker, I seek leave of the House for the question to be directed to the Minister of Mental
Health. Leave of sword, is there any objection? Appears to be none. Ingrid Neary.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is for the Minister for Mental Health. Does he stand by all his statements and actions?
Mr Speaker, first can I just take a moment to acknowledge how triggering the conversations have been around suicide for many people in New Zealand who have been affected by suicide in their families and their communities. I do stand beside my statements and actions, specifically that mental health and suicide prevention is a priority for this government, and my priorities for mental health, addictions and suicide is to increase access to timely mental health, addiction and suicide prevention support. Number two, to grow the mental health and addiction and suicide prevention workforce. And three, strengthen focus on prevention and early intervention.
Supplementary. Does he stand by his statement this week insisting that the Suicide Prevention Office would not be a victim of the government's cost cutting?
Yes, Mr Speaker. Look, can I take the opportunity to clear something up? I saw the change document for the first time with the officials taking me through it on Monday. They have taken me through it and showed with the change proposal, the proposal is actually to go from 5.5 FTE in the Suicide Prevention Office, which it currently is, to 6.5 in the change proposal, which is only a proposal, but it will increase capacity and capability in that office that will remain open. It has been misleading. The PSA put out a press release. It was to close. I was never informed of that, and it was not to close.
Why did his health officials double down on their advice to the media yesterday, saying that the number of roles to be disestablished and the number of roles to be integrated were essentially exactly the same as what they advised last week?
Well, in response to that question, I can only go by the assurance I got when I was given the change proposal for the first time on Monday. They took me through it and showed me where it has gone from 5.5 FTE to 6.5 FTE. I want to be very clear, and the officials have acknowledged I wasn't sufficiently briefed. I was not told it was to close. I've always been very clear. There's been a lot of discussion in the sector who are critical of the Suicide Prevention Office. One major commentator has called for it to close. I do not want it to close.
What is the practical difference between retaining only the functions of the office and closure, given that the Prime Minister has just confirmed in the House today that there are current roles that will no longer be filled?
Mr Speaker, I've been very clear, and I was even interviewed on Jack Tame on Q&A, that I've been disappointed by the Suicide Prevention Office. I think it's lacked real leadership. The sector has been disappointed, but I've never been of the view to delete it. I've always been of the view to actually how we can give it clear expectations, manage it, targets and goals. As part of the review of the Suicide Action Plan that I'm due to take in the next couple of months, I will be doing that with the Suicide Prevention Office.
Why did he ask his officials to publicly apologise?
I did not ask the officials to publicly apologise.
Why are officials publicly apologising when they're actually just following government directions to find 6.5% funding cuts across health?
Well, that's very simple, Mr Speaker, because the Fiscal Sustainability Program clearly states to find savings while still delivering quality public services, and delivering a Suicide Prevention Office is a quality public service.
Question number 9, Ricardo Mendes-March.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Social Development and Employment. Does she agree with the Prime Minister's recent statement that the average adult now is on the benefit for 13 years on average, and the under-25s are on the benefit for an average of 24 years?
Honourable Louise Upson.
Mr. Speaker, yes, in its full context. The Prime Minister was referring to independent evidence produced by Taylor Fry in 2022, which reported that someone on the JobSeeker benefit is expected to spend 13 years on benefit throughout their lifetime. The same evidence shows someone on a youth benefit is expected to spend 24 years on benefits throughout their lifetime.
Is she aware that the Taylor Fry report she just quoted actually says that only 0.5% of people on the benefit are expected to spend 24 years on a benefit throughout their lifetime?
Mr Speaker, anyone that spends up to 24 years of their future lifetime on welfare is a major issue for this government, and that's why we are focused on fixing it.
0.5. Why then has the Prime Minister and the Minister continued to say that under-25s are on the benefit for an average of 24 years?
Mr Speaker, because that's what the Taylor Fry report has said. For someone who goes on to youth payment or youth parent payment, unfortunately, the future lifetime expected that they will spend on welfare is up to 24 years. That is a disaster from anyone's book, and why we are focused with a social investment approach, focused on where the group have the highest risk of poorer life outcomes and interrupting it. We are not interested in allowing young people in this country, whether it's a small number or a large number, spending that amount of time stuck.
Is she aware that for that tiny 0.25% proportion of people, the modelling is taking into account 7 additional risk factors, including acute unplanned care from a public hospital, interaction with orangatamariki, and exclusion from school? And if so, why didn't she create a target to reduce these risk factors as opposed to just getting 50,000 people off the benefit?
Mr Speaker, the Taylor Fry modelling is based on really careful analysis of the IDI data, which is why it is so rich. It looks at people's past outcomes with the intention of trying to disrupt that from happening in the future. Whether it's one person, whether it's 100, whether it's 100,000, every one of those people count to me, and I'm unwilling to sit by and let them get stuck.
Is she confident in the accuracy of her and the Prime Minister's comments that the average young person is spending 24 years on a benefit?
Mr. Speaker, as I said in my primary answer, the context in which that was given was a discussion about long-term welfare dependency, the horrendous change that we have seen under the last 6 years with a significant increase in young people going onto welfare and staying on it, and the Taylor Fry report was one piece of the evidence that shows why we must prioritise this group.
Will she commit going forward to be clear that only 0.5% of people are projected to spend 24 years on the benefit as per the Taylor Fry report?
Mr. Speaker, what I will commit to this House is every single person, we will do our best to get them off welfare into work, because that's what improves their life outcomes. Whether it's 1 year or 24 years, it's not good enough.
Point of order. I seek leave to table the Taylor Fry report released under the Official Information Act.
So when the House is silent, we can all hear what you're saying.
Thank you.
The point of order, Carl. Carl Swindon, as much.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I seek leave to table the Taylor Fry report, the Social Outcomes Modelling 2022 results released to me under the Official Information Act.
Leave of swords, sir, for that purpose. Is there any objection? Appears to be none. Move now to question number 10, in the name of Cameron Brewer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Justice and asks, what target has the government set for a reduction in violent crime?
The Honourable Paul Goldsmith.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister announced on Monday that the government has set a target to see a reduction in the number of people who are the victims of an assault, robbery or sexual assault by 20,000. By setting a focused and ambitious target to reduce the number of victims of crime, we can focus attention, resources and accountability towards achieving better results.
Supplementary. Why does this government want to see a reduction in violent crime?
Mr. Speaker, it's important that all New Zealanders feel safe in their homes and in their communities. It's estimated that around 185,000 Kiwis, or 4.4% of the population, are victims of an assault, robbery or sexual assault, and we don't regard that as normal or acceptable. The previous government targeted reducing the prison population while violent crime increased. We have changed the target to reduce the number of victims of crime.
Supplementary. What steps have already been taken to help reach the target to see a reduction in violent crime?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the government's already taken a number of steps, including the introduction of a significant legislative package aimed at tackling gangs. We're boosting the powers of police to search gang members and other high-risk offenders, in addition to providing more access to rehabilitation for people on demand. And we've stopped funding for cultural reports.
Supplementary.
Supplementary, Cameron Brewer.
What steps are next to help reach the target to see a reduction in victims of violent crime?
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. We're restoring the three strikes legislation that the previous government repealed, showing that we will not tolerate repeat violent offending in our communities. We'll give judges additional tools to deal with serious repeat youth offenders, including military-style academies. We'll also limit excessive sentencing discounts so penalties actually fit the crime. There are, of course, many factors that have contributed to increase in violent crime in our communities, but one of the immediate tools available to us is to restore real consequences for crime.
The Honourable Dr. Duncan Webb.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. How will his gang patch legislation assist in achieving those targets when advice provided to him by the Ministry of Justice on 27 November states clearly that there's no strong evidence to show that such actions work to reduce long-term offending and, in fact, risks making it more difficult to change offending behaviours and may drive an increase in gang numbers?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think it was that it was the mixed attitude towards gangs over the past 6 years that led to contributed, no doubt, to a 50% increase in gang membership in our community. And so, Mr. Speaker, I think everybody acknowledges the negative impact that gang membership and intimidation in our communities have on our towns and our communities. And so, that bill is designed to give the police extra powers to deal with gang intimidation, and that'll help.
Question number 11, in the name of the Honourable Priyanka Radhakrishnan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Disability Issues. When did she receive the briefing titled Changes to Equipment and Modification Services and Flexible Funding to Manage FICAHA Expenditure? And what actions did she take upon receiving the briefing?
The Honourable Penny Simmons.
Mr. Speaker, I received the briefing on the 23rd of February 2024. I noted that FICAHA was making changes which were needed to reduce its forecast deficit as recommended. And as I have said multiple times, Mr. Speaker, these issues are inherited from the previous Labor government, and I am taking urgent steps to address the situation with our review. We have also put extra funding in to support FICAHA through to the end of this financial year, and we have signalled that FICAHA will get more money in the next budget.
How does she rationalise that with answers she gave in the House that suggest the first time she knew about the changes to reduce flexibility of disability support services was when she signed out a briefing on 14th March?
Mr. Speaker, I certainly received the briefing on the 22nd of February that these were initiatives that FICAHA was considering, and then they confirmed on the 14th of March that they would be implementing those changes. They also informed me in that briefing that before implementing these changes, FICAHA had a comprehensive communications and engagement plan outlining the changes being implemented. They also said they had tailored messages for each audience focused on ensuring people needing disability support the most continued to receive support.
Why did she only formally advise the Finance Minister of eligibility changes that resulted from FICAHA's funding shortfall on 20th March, 2 days after the announcement was made and implemented, as she has confirmed in written parliamentary questions 3593 and 3599?
The Minister of Finance is a rubber arm.
Because we were discussing budget issues at that meeting on the 22nd.
Why, given she was first aware of the proposed changes on 22nd or 23rd Feb, Did it take her till the 25th of March to first go to Cabinet, considering over 26,000 carers have been impacted by these changes?
Mr. Speaker, because in that paper on the 22nd of February, FICAHA had outlined two initiatives that they were taking to reduce its projected deficit. They also outlined that they were working with Treasury to see if their bid for cost pressures could be considered early. Also, in late January, FICAHA had informed me that their updated forecast showed that they would be within 2% of the threshold, which is manageable by me as a minister, and they were working to reduce it to a zero deficit.
Is the minister therefore saying that this timeline is correct, that she first became aware of FICAHA's funding issues on 15th December 2023, was briefed on proposed changes on the 22nd of February, signed out changes on 14th March, the changes were then announced and implemented with immediate effect on 18th March, but that she didn't act till the 25th of March?
No, I'm not saying that. I am saying that throughout this process, Whaikaha were updating me on their financial situation. In January, they updated me that they had reduced the deficit and they were working to bring it down to zero. In February, they put forward initiatives that would further reduce the deficit. In March, they weren't able to fulfil that reduction, and therefore it was discussed at a budget meeting.
Question number 12, the name of Dan Pedwar.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister of Education, what recent announcements has she made on curriculum and assessment?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Erica Stanford.
Mr. Speaker, last week I announced significant changes to the NCEA change program that has been underway since 2020. It is a priority for this government to ensure that we have a world-leading curriculum. This document should be the foundation of a high-performing education system supporting teachers to excel and learners to reach their potential. The current approach puts the cart before the horse, designing assessments before having a curriculum in place, and it is not best practice to design assessment before knowing what is to be assessed. Curriculum is the priority so that we can then deliver a well-designed assessment standards that we can have confidence in, and to achieve better public services, I will be delaying the NCEA change program by 2 years while we complete the curriculum.
Supplementary. What feedback has she received on this announcement?
Mr. Speaker, the support for this announcement from principals, parents, unions and teachers alike has been overwhelming. The Post-Primary Teachers Association President Chris Abercrombie was quoted in the New Zealand Herald this week saying, "It's important that we get a really good curriculum base, a good assessment folds out of good curriculum." While Dr. Nina Hood, founder of the Education Hub, agreed that the curriculum refresh needs to be finalised before redeveloping NCA to ensure that it was a, quote, robust and fit for purpose qualification.
Supplementary, how will this announcement lift student achievement?
Mr. Speaker, parents want to know that their children have every opportunity to succeed, and success starts with strong foundations. In addition to teaching the basics brilliantly in our primary and intermediate schools, this government has a laser focus on delivering a knowledge-rich curriculum to all students right up to Year 13. This decision will lift student achievement by delivering a knowledge-rich, world-leading curriculum, which acts as a central resource for teachers and a crucial tool to guide assessment and qualification design. The decision will ensure that consistency across the country so that every child, no matter where they live or attend school, will have access to the same knowledge at each year level.
Supplementary, what recent reports has she seen on curriculum?
I've seen the recent Eero report into the Aotearoa New Zealand Histories curriculum. This report highlights issues within the New Zealand Histories curriculum, but that are also issues experienced across all curriculum areas. High level, vague, lacking in specificity is not what the sector wants. The report shows that teachers want a more explicit curriculum with more off-the-shelf material and resources. Teachers are the most valuable resource that we have, and I will be working at pace to deliver what they need to experience success in the classroom, lift student achievement, and get this government on track to meet our ambitious targets and deliver better public services.
Here, here. Help us here. That concludes oral questions.